sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Stocks and a down week on an upbeat note. The Ebola virus continues to spread. Unemployment rate drops to 5.9%. And our guest, Tom McClellan, he'll be with us today on episode number 383 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're in the first week of October 2014. And already we're seeing some interesting signs of volatility increasing and volume increasing. As a matter of fact, last week, the volume was the most we've seen in months overall for the entire week. Dropped off a bit on Friday, even though we had a better than expected jobs number where unemployment rate dropped to 5.9%, 225,000 or so new jobs added to the payrolls. And all of that is very good in that we're seeing that the U.S. is definitely healing from a position of employment. We've also seen that real estate is getting a bit better. It was just a little bit soft there for a few months, and things got a bit better. Manufacturing has been stable, and we did see a little bit of a disappointment with the ISM Services Index. Nothing terrible at all. Still very high, very much above the 50-level demarcation point between contraction and expansion in about the 58 range, and that is good overall. The dollar, on the other hand, is screaming higher. I mean, just absolutely on a tear. That's causing big problems for gold, silver, commodities, oil. Matter of fact, oil closed at the lowest point that we've seen in some time, and that could be, on one hand, a good sign because the lower price you have to pay for oil and gas, the more potentially you have to spend. And at the same time, the lower that the input cost is for many companies to produce all sorts of goods. So there is some good and some bad. The problem, though, is that a higher dollar is deflationary. And at the same time, it's really not good for the rest of the world in that it costs much more for them to buy products of the U.S. So our exports are probably going to see some significant downstroke in the coming months, where our imports, which we are a net importer, of course, they're going to see a nice kick higher. Stock market did recover a bit on Friday from the down week. There was a lot of concern throughout the week on all of the geopolitical issues and the fact that the dollar had been climbing. Now, by the way, the dollar moved more than about 1.25% against the basket of currencies on Friday, and that is very significant. That kind of move in currencies doesn't happen that often, although lately we are seeing that it is happening more regularly. And the reason for that is that there is a very severe divergence in monetary policy when it comes to the developed countries. For example, we look at Japan. We talked about that. They're just trying to kill the yen as best as possible. We see Europe and Draghi, even though there was a lot of disappointment in the fact that he did not this week spell out very specifically the amount of money and timing of any bond purchases through his asset-backed security purchase plan, the quasi-quantitative easing program that he had talked about and promised. That really caused a bit of a stir. Because Draghi is not the type to hold back. If you haven't noticed, he says much more than he actually delivers. He does this quite regularly. And this time when he made his speech, not only did he have no mention to speak of, but even in the question and answers during the commentary, there really wasn't any kind of solid footing that we could say that, okay, well, the date they're going to start is this date. The amount of money they're going to put upon it every month or maybe in total is this amount, or the bonds they're going to buy or that. There was nothing. There was really just a a vast kind of crickets going on when that topic came up. He was much more inclined to talk about structural reform and fiscal reform versus the monetary policy, and that's what really spooked markets, and that's what really threw European markets into a downspin. And at the same time, you would have thought that the dollar, which did come back a little bit on that as the euro moved higher, would have had some sense of drop, but no, it did not. Little bit, ever so slight, but it didn't. And that caused the break finally on Friday when we saw the good number from jobs and the excitement about that and the fact that the U.S. economy is stronger than the other currencies and the countries and their currencies that are out there. But more importantly, what it also said was that there is going to be probably a quicker time period until the Fed actually stops their program. So whether they're going to raise their rates, I don't know, a quarter, a half, or something. Fact of the matter is that there is now the setup. It's all set that there is going to be an inclination to hold back on stimulus with the 5.9%. Remember, they were looking at 6.5% as the mark that they would say, hey, you know, 6.5% and 2% interest rate is the time when we're going to start cutting back stimulus. And now we're not at 2% for the inflation rate, but we are at 5.9. Now, they talked about adjusting that after we surpassed the 6.5, moved it down to 5.5, but nonetheless. So we did have a down week for markets, a lot of volume, tremendous volume, as a matter of fact, that would qualify for severe distributions by institutions throughout the week. And we did see a turnaround on Thursday. It was actually Thursday. There was a turnaround of markets where the market was down close to about, I would say 1% on the S&P. And we did see all of a sudden a turn when we hit some support, ramped it back towards the zero line by the end of the day Thursday. There was probably a lot of short covering going on ahead of the fact that there was going to be a jobs number coming out on Friday. And many people just didn't want to be in front of that. They neutralized their portfolio. They maybe hedged a little bit. Shorts covered, and voila. We had about a 1% day on the upside, plus on the NASDAQ, a little bit less, about 1% on the Russell, which has been really in really problematic territory. And the S&P was up about 1.2%. There's a lot of things in the news before we get to our guest, Tom McClellan. I have a lot of questions for him. I read his market reports, the McClellan Market Report, and look at his information on a regular basis. Very smart guy. But before we get to him, I want to talk about some of the things that are in the news and some of the things you need to be aware of coming up. It is here again. Yes, once again, we are right about to enter earnings season, starting at the close on Wednesday when Alcoa, while it's not in the Dow Jones anymore, Alcoa will be reporting earnings, and estimates anticipation for that earnings are very positive. Alcoa has been recovering quite strongly. Although now with the cost of all commodities coming down a little bit, there may be some hesitation by management to throw out a lot of good news out there. But we do see Alcoa starting off, and the following week is really when a lot of it begins to turn in pretty fast. And we're going to be seeing some of the banks reporting. We see J.P. Morgan, and we'll see Bank of America in the beginning of the season. And Google then comes up and a few others. So keep a watch out for earnings. Already what we have seen is that last quarter, going into the middle part of it, there was a lot of very high anticipation that this quarter, the quarter we're in coming up into, would have a very good earnings season. And we saw estimates pretty high. And ever since then, they've been dropping precipitously. Now, on one hand, that's good because we see that when companies beat analyst expectations, obviously, the company stock, their stock usually goes up, assuming they have decent guidance. On the other hand, the bad news is that we are seeing a lot of analysts cut earnings estimates. So that's not really good. This will be a real key because we did see a nice recovery from some of the concerning areas that were related to the first and second quarter recently. And the outlook, I think, will be very important, as it always is. coming into this particular earnings season. So we're going to watch that very carefully, and we'll report back to that. Also, I mentioned Stocktoberfest. If you haven't been watching over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, we've already covered a number of stocks, Molson Coors, Walgreens, CVS Corp, and lots more coming next week. So take a look at that. Each and every day, we'll have a stock or two that will be on the site, and we're going to go over the current ratings, the estimates. We're going to show you the outlook in terms of earnings and revenue, the underlying fundamentals, and some charts. All that's going to be there, and you can see what our T and F score is overall for those. Now, aside from that, we got to talk a little bit about a couple of things that are in the news right now. Clearly, this whole Ebola scare and outbreak or whatever's going on with the Ebola virus. I mean, we do know if you look, even just look it up on Wikipedia, you'll find that this is clearly the worst outbreak in history. And probably that's why we're seeing some of the spread of it happening here in the U.S. Now, there's only one or two cases that we saw. Of course, a few people were brought back. They don't really count in terms of, quote unquote, spreading the disease because they were brought back intentionally to cure them. And they did very well. Now, this other situation where the man in Texas who came on a plane and went to the hospital and then they told him he was, you know, okay, go home and, you know, rest and take these meds, et cetera, call me next day or whatever. Turned out to have Ebola. Turned out that he was actually in his house and potentially infecting others who are now under quarantine and having all sorts of problems with that. And then we hear that there's a possible case in D.C. And now we're hearing scares that, hey, there's some people that are sick on a plane and everybody's freaking out about it. What we're finding is that there is some opportunity. We talked about this on the DH Unplugged show last week. And in particular, you saw that of number of stocks, but three in particular did very well with the information that came out, because the fact of the matter is, with even it doesn't spread, and even if where we are right now is where it is going to be, there is a potential real problem outside the U.S. So even though we don't maybe going to see, anything major happen here, and, you know, the CDC has it controlled, and President Obama was on, and he was saying, hey, this is not going to happen, and we're not going to see any problems. And we also saw that Jack Lew was on, and a variety of others, and head of CDC, hey, this is not going to be a problem. We have it well contained. We have, you know, all sorts of diagnostics, and we have abilities to make sure this doesn't happen. The fact of the matter is that it's not so simple. And when we look at this from the aspect of containment and curing it, there really is no answer right now. And as such, we need to think about, okay, well, what is going to be the potential? Now, we already know that the two people that were brought back, the first two people that were brought back to the United States, they are doing well. The gentleman in Texas has taken a turn for the worse. And again, we're not sure why or what is the cure right now. But the stocks that are at least in the stream of potential for having either some kind of, well, they call it a cure, or at least some kind of a drug that can interact and slow down the progress, have done very well. The number one would be Tecmira, symbol TKMR. And now this stock is very volatile. It's out of Canada. And they have what probably is the closest to a, at least what is at this point, a drug that can fight the Ebola virus. Then you have BioCryst, BCRX, and Sarepta Therapeutics, SRPT. Now, those stocks were on fire on Thursday and Friday, and probably over the weekend, why they were up towards the end of the day. Sarepta up about 8%, BioCryst about 9.5%, I believe it was, and Tecmira up about 16% or thereabout. And the reason for that was because over the weekend, we could see a lot more spread. We could see a lot more news. We could see a lot more coverage. People would be more concerned, and who knows what's going to happen. And a lot of players that wanted to get into that stock over the long weekend. Now, whether or not that's going to hold next week, we'll see. The more there is news related to it, the higher the potential is for these stocks to go. The more that we see that there is an outbreak that spreads outside of, let's call it, certain countries in Africa, the more potential these stocks have. One of the reasons is that governments will want to fund these companies in some way. There will be also a lot of people looking for these companies to fast track whatever they're doing. And when you look at the various health organizations around the world, they're going to be looking for some way to also contain this, because we already know that in Africa, for the most part, the death rate for Ebola is, I don't know, what is it, 90% mortality rate? That's pretty ridiculous. Very sad. And over the years, there's been nothing that has helped that once the outbreak occurs. Once somebody becomes a carrier of it, for the most part, there's really no cure. It's a terrible situation, but these drug companies obviously are doing very well. Then you have the other side of it, that there are a lot of players that may say, hey, you know what? These companies have something close to a potential drug, and maybe they're going to be in play for a takeover. So Techmira, BioCryst, and Sarepta Therapeutics are the three that kind of fit that mold that you may want to take a look at. But obviously, they're very volatile. They are very apt to get a lot of movement, tremendous movement on news items. And if there's no news on it, probably drop a bit. When the news comes, they spike pretty hard. Something else you want to look at in the news, Rosanoff from Brazil, the current president, is expected to continue after the election this weekend. And I don't know how that's going to play out, because we've seen that when the polls were in her favor, markets didn't do very well. And now it looks like, for all intents and purposes, unless something crazy happens at the end here, that she's holding the lead over her challengers, and we'll have to see how that plays out next week when it comes to Brazilian markets. There could be a relief that it's over, or there could be another leg down for Brazilian stocks. We'll see what happens there. Anyway, we're going to get to our guest, but I want to tell you, give you a little teaser. What we're going to talk about real quickly when we get back is this whole Ben Bernanke thing with trouble getting his mortgage. Yes, you heard me. Refinancing was very difficult for former Fed chief Ben Bernanke with his massive salary that was cut recently, because he's now no longer working full time, right? But he does get about $250,000 per speech. But still says he had trouble. And we're going to talk about, just for a moment, this whole issue about Hewlett-Packard breaking up into two companies. We'll just touch upon that right when we get back from our guest. Let's get right to it. And our guest today, Tom McClellan, hasn't been with us for a while. He is a gentleman who studies the market, and not only studies the market itself, but the internals with quite a bit of gusto, and really knows what's going on about all the different technicals and variables that go into play. You can check out all of his stuff at mcoscillator.com. We'll talk about that in a minute more. Tom, how are you?
Good morning.
Hey, you know, there's been a interesting change in, I don't call it sentiment or not even direction, but just the mood of the market over the last several weeks, to let's call it a month. And I know that you do a lot of tracking of the, you know, new highs, new lows, and the various features of the markets. Tell me some of the more interesting things that you have been observing.
Well, back in the summer of this year, we started to notice divergences in the breadth data, the advances minus declines. The AD line, we'd call it, if you do it on a cumulative basis, wasn't keeping track with the Dow and the S&P, and that's typically a sign that liquidity has left the building. And liquidity starts affecting smaller stocks first, but then eventually it comes around to bite the big ones. And that's what we saw in September, with a very normal seasonal period of weakness that's gotten everybody's panties in a wad, and they're all panicking, and we're official correction territory on CNBC, and all sorts of gloom and doom, and put call ratios zooming up as people are buying puts, because they think this is the big one. Finally, the Fed is shutting off the party bowl, and we're all going to die, and so when you start hearing that kind of sentiment on TV, you know that the bottom's just about in, and I think it is.
You know, it's interesting that when you talk about the Fed, I've tracked your studies, and a lot of times you talk about in the last McClellan market report how, there's a chart, and the chart talks about, okay, QE1 ending, QE2 ending, QE2 kind of like washing a little bit, then QE3 beginning, and, you know, what happens to markets and things of that nature. There was obviously, as we know, a very clear and obvious situation that occurred when QE1 ended. Markets were not happy, right? Things
liquidity. Well, we had the flash crash, yeah.
Exactly.
Not I would happy call that an illiquidity event.
Yes. And then on QE2, we saw the same kind of thing happen. Where
the summer of 2011, over. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then QE3, now do we have to wait until the day it ends for something to go on? Or because this is, the other one was sharp, right? The QE1 and QE2 are sharp endings.
Pretty much, yeah. And so what the Fed is trying to do this time, they're trying to invoke the "it's different this time" rule by saying, no, we're not going to end it sharply. We're going to taper quietly and slowly and wean the market off of QE. That's their idea. And actually, even when the Fed stops doing the outright purchases, they're still going to be reinvesting their interest that they earn on treasury bonds and on the mortgage-backed securities. So as those checks come in every month, they'll have to get reinvested. So the line is going to still creep up a little bit higher in terms of the Fed assets. Hopefully the Fed can somehow figure a way how to reduce its book someday without crashing the market. I don't know how to do that. They tried that in summer of 2008 when Tim Geithner was the president of the New York Fed, and they thought, oh, it's an illiquidity crisis. It would be a good idea to have the Fed sell bonds and suck money out of the market. That turned out to be a good idea if you wanted to get the challenger candidate elected president, which actually did happen in 2008. And Tim Geithner ended up being his treasury secretary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So maybe that was a good idea, depending on how you frame the question. But in terms of investors, I'm not sure how the Fed's going to get itself out of this. I don't think it's going to try for quite a while.
Yeah, I mean,
but once it finally does later this decade, then I think we'll have
some more. Yeah, we're talking about $4.2 trillion worth of holdings that they've already signaled that they're going to let, you know, eventually just wash off, not necessarily sell any, because, you know, that would be the only right thing to do in terms of them. Now, I think the most fascinating thing that people have to understand, and you'll probably agree with me on this, is that the Fed basically has essentially an unlimited amount of money, you know, from different ways of them grabbing money and buying things. And if they have a $4.5 or close to that $1 trillion bond portfolio, and they don't want to see that get decimated, the two things they're going to do is they'll do what they can to hold it up. Secondly, what they'll do is they'll hold it for maturity, right? So
But that's not even the way that the Fed looks at anything. Their goal is the stability of the banking system. They talk about the mandates from Congress in terms of low inflation and high employment. That's what they officially declare to be their goal. But their real goal, they're bankers, they are out for self-preservation of their system. So that's what's going to be really driving their motivation, is making sure that can survive okay over and above any other goals that they may have.
Right, and the goals, obviously, of what they do have of employment, let's say, directly impact the banking system. The more people employed, more money flows through the systems, right? So, I mean, it all works out together.
Yep.
Let's talk about gold for a second here. It's a kind of a tough topic to look at, because I know some time ago you talked about, it looks like it's getting a little close to the point where it should be basing out here. But gold has been on a direct crash course down. One of the catalysts, obviously, is the ever-rising dollar. So
right. How
is this looking for you right now?
Well, it's true that gold looks like it's in a crash course if you look at the price of gold measured in dollars.
Right.
If you look at the price of gold measured in euros, it looks really strong. It's had a nice sideways basing period. It's found support at its rising bottoms line. I suspect that right now the price of gold is roughly 940, 950 euros, something like that. I don't have it in front of me right now. At the point when we see gold prices break above 1,000 euros, the round number effect coming in, I think you'll see a big recognition wave of people piling into gold. They're not doing that today. Today's not that day, and gold is breaking below $1,200 an ounce, which was one of the things we'd been looking for and kind of given up looking for. It was supposed to have a bottom this summer, and instead the bottom kind of split into two, with one bottom in June and one bottom now, I believe. The dollar is blowing off, and that's fueling what we're seeing in gold prices measured in dollars. At the point that the dollar finally tops out, usually when you have a dollar blow off, the downward slope matches the upward slope, very symmetrical. So you can expect that we're going to see money coming out of the dollar and into the other currencies at about the same kind of slope that we've been seeing this blow-off up move. When that moment comes is the harder point to answer.
Right,
but,
exactly.
But as that happens, you're going to start to see gold bouncing back. You'll start to see small caps bouncing back because small caps have been getting hurt by the stronger dollar. Hasn't hurt big cap stocks, but small caps it has, because a stronger dollar makes it hard for small cap companies to sell their products overseas, where big cap companies like Coke and GM and IBM, they're working in all the different currencies anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Working all the angles.
Yeah.
Exactly. But one of the things that you talked about, I'm just going to go back to liquidity for a second, was that your ratio adjusted, what do you call it, the ROSI, or the ratio adjusted summation index, made it above plus 500 in August. Can you kind of go through that? Because I think you made that point, and it was kind of something important that you're bringing to the markets.
Yeah, I got to tell you how to build the clock a little bit before I can tell you what time it is. The ratio adjusted summation index, it's a version of the indicator that my parents created, the McClellan summation index, back in 1970. And what it's looking at is the acceleration taking place in the advanced decline statistics. When it gets down to a normal, when you have a normal correction, it'll get down back down to normal, to neutral or below. And then on the next upsurge, we want to see how good the upsurge is in the market, how strong the breadth numbers are, and if the ratio-adjusted summation index can get up above plus 500, that's an important threshold. That says that there is plentiful liquidity in general. Now, you can still have a garden variety correction like we've just had. You know, the market doesn't go up in a straight line, so you surge forward and you correct a little bit, and we're in the process of doing that. But that plus 500 reading that we had this summer, it did say that there is liquidity to back us up and to provide enough fertilizer for the next advance once we get done with this correction, which I think we're done with. So that's good news. We're also heading into the period of favorable seasonality starting in late October and continuing on into early next year, and we're heading into the third year of a presidential term. Third years are always up years, except for 1931 when we had the Dust Bowl, and except for 1939 when Hitler was marching through Poland. So except for conditions like that, the third year is an up year, and I expect this one to be a good one.
So the thing that you mentioned, though, was that the seasonality. Let's talk about seasonality for a second. So
sure.
Talk about the we'll call it the last 2 months of the year, for lack of a better, just to keep it clean, okay?
Yep.
Is that seasonality. What is that all about?
November to May, or November to June, really, is the period of seasonal strength every year. It's been going on for a long time. A lot of people used to think that it was related to the agricultural cycle, or perhaps related to Wall Street guys leaving town and going out to the shore during the summertime so it would get weak because nobody was around to trade. Although, back in the days before air conditioning, the seasonality didn't work that way. It worked the opposite, so it's kind of funny. If you go back 100 years, seasonality worked totally different. But starting in really late October, on average, the market tends to perform really well from about late October into June of the next year. And then it tends to be flat to slightly downward on average from June to September. So we're getting out of the period of seasonal weakness now. October is kind of mushy, and you look around for some firmer footing, you'll find it much more easily at the end of October. So right now, the month of October is going to be a great environment to trade, and eventually it'll be a great environment to invest. And those two are different activities. But November and December should be strong months for the market, should be especially strong months for small caps to come bouncing back as the dollar finally tops and starts heading down and gives them a little bit of relief.
Yeah, so now, I mean, it's interesting because the dollar moving up hasn't really necessarily affected, again, small caps, yes. I'm talking about the bigger picture, right? You know, overall, it hasn't seen that much of a real problem being posed, again, a little bit, nothing major. For the amount, by the way, I'm talking about for the amount of movement we've had, too. It's pretty substantial, right? I mean, this dollar move is pretty substantial.
It is, yes. It's bigger than most of the other patterns for the last few years, if you look at just the dollar index. There's a big race to the bottom between the Japanese currency and the European currency, and the dollar is kind of the opposite side of that trade. And so both Europe and Japan are trying to rescue their economy through crashing their currencies, and that's pushing up the dollar. I think that it's going to become an overreaction by everybody, and that's what's going to allow the dollar to finally top and head back the other way. Picking that moment is a little bit hard. We're very stretched. We look at the commitment of traders data for futures, and I have a combination indicator that I'm going to be writing about today in my Chart and Focus article. It'll be posted on our website late Friday. People can tune in and see it there at mcoscillator.com. The commitment of traders data for all the currencies is at just a huge extreme. The commercial traders, the smart money, they are long the dollar in a big way. Now, they often are early, but they always end up being right in the long run. And they're, and on this combination indicator that compiles seven different currency contracts into one based on their dollar value, this is the most extreme net long position by the smart money commercials since the euro was created in 1999. They're saying that this is a huge top for the dollar, huge bottom for the euro, and when the turn comes, it's going to be a powerful move the other way.
So now let me just understand that, because I want to understand what you just said. You said they're very long the dollar. Mm-hmm.
They're long the excuse me. They're short the dollar.
Oh, they're short
long
the dollar.
They're long the other currency.
Oh, they're short. I didn't understand that at first. So they're short the dollar. And when did they start amassing that big position?
It's been over the past couple of months. But now they're this indicator that I'll be writing about today is at the most extreme value in the last 15 years since the euro's been trading.
Wow. So they're really betting hard.
It's a huge bet that the dollar is going to top and turn downward, that the other currencies are going to bottom and turn upward. And if I said that wrong at the first part, I apologize. It is tough to get, you know, east and west and dollar up and dollar down. Your mind gets turned around.
And it may have been my hearing.
You have to concentrate hard.
But good news, we can listen to it if we want. But bottom line is, big bet, smart money on short dollar. That's the bottom line. Okay, gotcha. So that would actually be good for potentially for gold, for example, metals, for oil, for commodities, generally speaking.
Generally speaking.
But that hasn't been playing out. And these guys that have that big money can actually weather some of the movement versus some of the other money that may be quick moving in and out, short covering, short squeezing like we've been seeing.
Yeah, very true. Often the commercials in a regular commodity, not a currency, but in a regular commodity like cotton or gold or something, the commercials are often the producers. So they're selling their forward production. Well, if they sell it big, it's a sign that the smart money bets that prices are going to go down and they want to sell it now while the prices are up. If they refrain from doing that, that's a sign that they think the prices are going to go higher.
Right
now, in that vein, the commercial traders of copper futures are net long in a big way. Not the biggest ever, but just about.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're betting on a big rebound for copper prices, which would fit with the idea that the dollar level is going to go down. A less valuable dollar would mean you need more of them to buy a pound of copper,
mm-hmm.
which would push up copper prices.
Right. Now, you also mentioned, again, I'm really focusing a lot because there's so much information in the last market report that you did at the end of September. And one of the things you talk about is the Hindenburg trigger. Now, this is one of those interesting things that doesn't happen that often. And I have some questions about that. One of the big things is that there's essentially a double confirmation that needs to happen to have the full Hindenburg triggered. Is that correct?
It's called the Hindenburg Omen.
Yep.
And it was created by a guy named Jim Mika, who we just lost in August. He just passed away. Fascinating guy. He lost his sight as an adult. So he was blind.
Wow.
He's a blind mathematician and a market follower. Just a brilliant guy.
Wow.
I mean, I can't do it without looking at a chart.
I can't
imagine.
He could
manage to do it.
Right.
And he, unfortunately, was walking on the side of a road with his seeing eye dog and got hit by a car and died.
The
dog survived, but he died and we lost him. It's just a tragic story. Mm. But he created this Hindenburg Omen as an adaptation of an indicator that other people had looked at. Gerald Appel many years ago had what he called his split market sell signal, when if you had, on the same day, if you had more than 45 new highs and new lows on the same day, that was a sign that something was screwy. Well, Gerald Appel never adjusted that for the changing number of issues traded on the NYSE, so that's one of the adjustments that Jim Mika did, is to make it a percentage of the total issues, and also to add a few other rules to filter out some of the bad signals. So we had a Hindenburg Omen trigger in September that says you got a potential for something bad. There are more warnings of trouble than there are actual trouble. So sometimes the warning comes and it doesn't actually pan out.
Mm-hmm.
It's an omen. It's not a guarantee. But we did get some weakness by seeing that both new highs and new lows at one point in September were flashing high levels. And that's a sign that there's huge rotation going on. There's huge disagreement. And that's why it's a sign of trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I think we got the fulfillment in late September with the sell-off that we had, and now I think we got oversold enough, and we can start upward again.
Yeah. So it's interesting because have you noticed over the last several years, we'll talk about, let's go back two years. The valleys, the sell-offs, they're not as significant in terms of corrective action. Now, there are some stocks that will get hit, but, I mean, it's a relatively time period-wise quick, right? I mean, we've compressed the time period for corrections dramatically.
Well, not just the time period. The magnitude is less, and that's a symptom of a very liquid market. When you have illiquidity, prices have to wander far to try to find some available money or to buy. When there's plenty of money to go around, the prices don't have to travel very far to find what they need. And so that's, you see that in lower total absolute volatility. It shows up in indicators related to that, like the VIX, which is what people think about what the volatility will be. And we're seeing all that showing up, low standard deviation of prices and returns. It's just a much more linear uptrend, and that's likely to continue for more of this decade. We don't get into the real trouble till later in the decade, probably around 2018, based on some really long forward-looking indicators that we have. Of course, the federal government and the Fed itself could screw things up before then, but
which they've been known to do.
The liquidity that's in the system is probably going to last for a while.
Interesting. Yeah, and obviously that has to go with the fact that there has been so much liquidity pumped in, and the fact that it's not just a U.S.-based phenomenon. I mean, we have the rest of the world, essentially, or the major countries, pushing money in as well. And as we all know, that whether they're buying bonds or they're doing so, it always finds its way somehow to trickle into the market.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is that it hasn't caused inflation yet in terms of consumer prices. It has caused inflation based on the old definition of inflation, which was how much money is there. But it hasn't, and according to the newfangled way that economists like to talk about inflation, which is consumer prices. And that's a really interesting thing. I attribute that to the fact that boomers are retiring, and there's not enough of the young people coming in to drive up consumption and demand, so prices are having to stay low because nobody's willing to do that. I think at the point when the echo boom generation, which peaked in the birth year of 1990, when those kids start getting into buying houses and buying bigger cars, then they're going to really start driving up prices. My daughter was born in 1990, but so she's only 24. She's not ready to buy your McMansion and your stock portfolio yet, but she'll get there someday. And so when her whole cohort starts becoming the economic engine, we can start to having some inflation again, and I think that that is coming. And now the Fed has provided all the fuel for it with all this excess money supply, so that's going to be a tough thing to live through.
Yep, it sure is. I mean, I have a little disagreement about inflation. I do agree that utilizing just the official numbers and the official mathematics behind it, that inflation is contained and all that. But, I don't know about you. Everything I buy costs more across the board. My insurance is more. Generally speaking, the food is more. Just a kind of life is more.
Yes, but Andrew, you don't understand. So you need to look at the proper model of how things are much more delicate and much more nuanced. You need somebody smarter than you to explain it how it really works.
I guess it doesn't cost
just looking at prices. What do you think doing that?
Yeah, exactly. What the heck is wrong with me, right? I don't know.
I know.
It's crazy. All right, hey, listen, thanks. I know that you have a trial that you do over at mcoscillator.com. We'll make sure to put the link on the show notes for this particular show on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I always appreciate you coming on and sharing your wisdom.
Well, it's nice to do that, to have me on, and if people want to come visit our website, they can find out about our subscription newsletters, but you can sign up for free for our weekly Chart and Focus. No strings attached. We won't send you any email marketing. It's just an actual free lunch to find out more about the indicators that we use and what we're thinking. One chart a week, and we look at it in depth, and there's a sign-up box right on the homepage. And you can look at actually in our Learning Center and see all the past issues of that article series. It's kind of a bunch of different, nice, interesting, and a diverse mix of articles on different topics related to technical analysis.
And I read it all the time, so I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. One thing you notice from Tom McClellan is that he's a gentleman who continues to utilize the same well-calculated methodologies. And that's an important part of investing. If it works, stick with it. And he has studied markets for a very long time. He is a student of markets of the markets, and you know, doesn't use emotion at all. And I think it's a very important feature. It's a very tough thing to do, but this is why I like Tom and all the things that he writes. So I would really encourage you to check out what he has and what he has to offer. All right, we talked about how we're going to just kind of get into this whole discussion about Ben Bernanke, former Fed chief, not being able to refinance his mortgage. He mentioned this kind of in passing at a luncheon, I think it was, last week, and it made big news. I wonder if it's true, and I wonder what the details are. This, I did some digging and to try to find out what was this all about. I don't know how this hit you. I don't know what you think about this. You know, was it something that struck you as odd that Ben Bernanke couldn't refinance his mortgage? More so, the big question is, why was Ben Bernanke refinancing a mortgage? From the records, it looks like in 2011, he refinanced a mortgage, house valued about $900,000 in D.C., three bedroom, two bath. About $600,000 left on his mortgage back in 2011. And I wonder, why is a guy who's earning $250,000 a speech trying to refinance a mortgage that was at, I think, 4.5%? I mean, what is he going to refinance down to? He was looking for a 30-year, which is also strange. I thought it was a little bit strange. Unless he's a big advocate of just borrow as much as you can and pay it off over time, and who cares? But you would think that at the levels that he's at, that maybe it would be time to pay off his mortgage. But aside from that, the story goes like this. That supposedly it was some of the robots that were involved in the mortgages. So they looked at the fact that he didn't have a full-time job. He didn't have a regular income, even though he had good assets, even though that he had income from his own company, $1 million. He has $1 million book deal. He has a $250,000 speech deal that he does, I don't know, 4 or 5 times a year he speaks. That brings in some good money, much more money than he made as a Federal Reserve chief. So maybe it was this weird thing that he just put it in online, which is odd to me for all the people that he knows out there. But he put it in online and somehow, I don't know, the algorithm that says whether you can have a mortgage or not said, hey, no. But again, this is a refinance, and that's even easier to get than a regular mortgage. So something's a little fishy with this, to be honest with you, and I'm not sure I really believe it. And it does go back to the whole idea of the Fed doing what they can in their quote-unquote communication process to, you know, try to make sure the banks are flush with cash, bring down interest rates as long as possible, make the public believe that, hey, you know, we have a much longer time than we need, really because of the fragility of the banking and financial markets to keep interest rates really low and to keep the Fed involved. Because this is definitely directly one of those things that would say, hey, you know what, if that's the case, think about the little guy. I mean, that's the message that's coming across. Think about the little guy. Think about me and you. Boy, if Bernanke can't get a mortgage, I mean, could Barack Obama get a mortgage? How about Biden? I mean, if the big guys can't get it, what chance do we have? So this maybe is somewhat of a story that is being blown out of proportion. And it could be also, I'm not going to go so far as saying that he's lying about this, but I think that maybe there's a little bit more to the story that needs to be told, because it doesn't seem very likely to me that with the income that he had, maybe he didn't fill out the application right. Maybe he, I don't know. You know, there's 100 different things that could prevent you from getting a mortgage or a refi. Alan Krueger recently said that he couldn't get a mortgage. What kind of faith do we have in our federal officials, the financial guys that don't have their finances in order and can't get mortgages? It would seem like these are the guys that should have everything right in a row, ready to go, send it off to their people, know some players out there, have relationships, and be able to get a mortgage. But they can't. Kind of on the other side of this, aside from, oh my gosh, what does that mean for us? I say, oh my gosh, I can't believe these guys aren't able to put it together enough to get themselves financially situated. They can show what they need to show in order to get a mortgage. Kind of scary. I'm just telling, I know it's difficult. I just listen. You know, I just bought a house. I decided the last minute not to pay cash and to go out and get a 30-year for part of, just not a big mortgage, nothing major at all. But, you know, I said, listen, if I get money at 4%, what the heck? So it was not the easiest process because it wasn't easy because of income or the loan to value or the house, none of that. It was not easy because of all the documentation and all the things that you needed to provide. Every time you moved a dollar from an account to another account or took out money, or they wanted information, they wanted proof, they wanted statements, and they wanted the enormity of the information that I needed to provide to get this mortgage was unbelievable. But you know what? I did it in less than 3 weeks and got a mortgage, no problem. So I really don't understand what this whole hubbaloo is up about with Bernanke and with Kruger, how they can't get a mortgage. I think we'll see some more about this in the news over the next couple of weeks and some clarification of this, because again, it doesn't smell kosher. Something about it's a little bit stinky, a little fishy. Now, unfortunately, we're not going to be having a DH Unplugged this week because I wanted to talk about this next topic with John C. Dvorak. He's the one that would bring us a lot of this information, but maybe this is something that's going to be very good. You know, markets have a way these days of seeing things as a cup half full, definitely not half empty. And we saw news over the weekend that Hewlett Packard is going to split itself up into two companies. One company is going to do the personal computers and the printers, and the other company is going to do more so, we'll call it corporate services and business. They're going to be doing some of the hardware and the service sector. Now, obviously, what this tells me on one side is that, hey, there's a component of Hewlett Packard, one of those two, not doing so well. Think of it as splitting up between good bank and bad bank, or good company and bad company. There's a reason that they're splitting. There could be a couple of good reasons. Maybe it's to unlock the value, because we're seeing that, well, the PC business has been, you know, showing a bit of a lull over the last few years, and printer business is not doing as well, and their corporate services business maybe is doing a bit better, and they have a better opportunity there, and corporate hardware, and therefore they're able to unlock the value of that. Now, if that is the case, what you would find, I would think, is that one part of the company, the one that's not doing so well, should really see a downtick very significantly when this all plays out. On the other hand, you should see the other side of the company doing well. You should see, I would assume it's going to be, the benefit's going to be towards the side of the business services and the hardware. You would think that's the company they're trying to unlock the value of. It can't be the printers and the PCs. But everybody views Hewlett Packard primarily as a printer and a PC company. And that's been a drag on shares for a long time. Well, now they're splitting up and they're splitting into two companies, we could find really a much better differentiation between the two, and hopefully the companies will be managed separately. That would be a big issue also, the management. Who's going to be in charge of what? Are they going to be switching around things or just keeping the same old management doing the same old things? And if that's the case, I don't know if that's really going to be beneficial. We'll see on Monday how this news hits. I would venture to say that this would probably be a net positive for tech shares, net positive for Hewlett Packard, at least initially. And then after we find out exactly some of the reasons, rationale of why they're doing this split, of why they're doing the separation, and the timing of it, I think you'll see a lot of plays being made on the company. You know, again, if it is a situation where it's a net zero, where you have, hey, one company's not doing very well, and the other side of the company is doing very well, initially, there may not be too much of a move, because don't forget that if you own shares today, when this transaction completes, you'll own shares of both companies. The play is going to be on the day that they do this split of the company, the breakup of the company, to potentially short the part of the company that's going to be holding on to the printers and PCs and go long the other side, the one that does the corporate and corporate hardware and corporate services. So keep that in mind. Watch Hewlett Packard over the next number of days and see what happens. Tesla's also in the news, going with the driverless discussion. So that Elon Musk put out a tweet about a week ago saying, hey, isn't it about time that we come up with some kind of an announcement? And I think that he slated that on October 9th. So everybody's thinking that it's possibly going to be something about the driverless vehicle. And they're moving to that. One of the companies that you want to watch is Mobileye. Mobileye has been the company that has been thought to be the player that will be the one that Tesla uses to bring on their driverless vehicles, and that stock has been doing very well, though there was some recent downgrades of the company, I believe. And I think that this news is going to help to see Mobileye really move to the next level, if in fact it is the news that we think it's going to be, not just a new vehicle, let's say. So Tesla is going to be in play. You're going to watch probably Solar City, because that has a sympathetic response to all the Tesla moves. It's another Musk company. And Mobileye, I would watch all three of those particular companies and watch what happens there. We also saw that there was a lockup that was expiring for the CEO of GoPro. That was last week, and on Thursday, I believe it was. Stock down about 11%. Popped back about 4 or 5% on Friday, I believe it was. And you know, we're going to see that there's more of a lockup expiration coming up. This is one of the things that you see, that there's a period of time where insiders can't sell after an IPO. Once that lockup expires, oftentimes a lot more shares that hit the market potentially, and that often is a sign of a sign for people to come into the company and do some shorting. So keep watching some of those recent IPOs that came out. We're still in the Pollo Loco camp of a short, and it still hasn't really gone down too much, but it hasn't been moving very much to the upside either. Just so much this company can move. For goodness sake, it's just a chicken company, just a food company, I should say, really more so. And how much of a PE expansion can you see on something like that, even though you did see the service index, you know, in the 58 range that we mentioned earlier. Other than that, it's probably going to be a pretty busy week with all of the news out there. We did see that there was some additional news out of Hong Kong that there's going to be a pretty much a 0 hour coming up where the protesters that have been just filling the streets unbelievably. If you haven't seen those pictures, they're quite unbelievable to see all those people protesting the pro-democracy group that and students that are filling the streets looking at the current actions of the government that may come to pass in 2017, sometime in the future. But nonetheless, there is some concern that the democratic, or at least the quasi-democratic way of Hong Kong, even though it is China, that Hong Kong may be in trouble here. And there's a lot of people protesting this whole thing. They don't want to see the China taken over here. And they want to keep their quasi-independence, if you will, if that's what you can call it. And the streets have been filled. We're going to be seeing the end of the China week that saw the holiday week that saw the markets close. They'll be reopening next week, and we'll see what the reaction is on those markets. It could be quite interesting. And we're going to be watching the dollar and gold. And, you know, gold is really at a precarious situation right now. If you watch the miners, they got pummeled. We have a position in gold and silver and miners very, very, not happy, frankly, about the performance of those positions, in that we did see the drop off a cliff, essentially, with all of this move on the dollar. I'm still of the mindset, not absolute, but getting a little bit more concerned about it by the day, that there is still a play in gold and silver. But right now, there's obviously a big seller out there, plus the fact that the dollar's been moving up, and it's been a problem. We talked about this with Tom McClellan a little while ago. So keep an eye on all those and see where the bottoming of this does happen. Because oftentimes with gold and silver, when the bottom does hit and all of a sudden the shorts get squeezed, you see a major turn. And if in fact, as Tom was mentioning, the smart money is short the U.S. dollar, probably getting hammered right now. But if the smart money is short the U.S. dollar and they keep on pressing upon that, and we did see possibly a blow off top of the dollar on Friday, well, there may be some upside from here a little bit, but the potential for them to turn and pretty violently turn is definitely there. So probably it's going to happen with earnings if we do see some concern there. Probably going to happen if there is some kind of good news out of Europe, hopefully, eventually. That would definitely be something that would be a turning point for all of this. Other than that, make sure to check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com, Stocktoberfest. Of course, the Aero strategy, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. We manage your money there, $50,000 minimum. All that information is on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you have any questions, of course, write me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for telling your friends about us. Thanks for being there. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.